The Winners Club is the weekly podcast that shares the highlights and insights from some of the most meaningful and impactful conversations from the number one community on Clubhouse, The Winners Club.
Pleasure to be here with you today, and thanks for that. I have the real pleasure to run Surface Against Sewage, which is a bit of an oddly named organisation, because we're not just surfers, and we don't just focus on the issue of sewage, but that's where it started back in 1990. There was a huge problem in the UK with pollution of our waters from sewage, and the organisation was formed then by a group of surfers. But I took over in 2008, in the last financial crash, actually, and sort of refounded the organisation as one of the country's leading marine conservation and campaigning charities. My passion, and I tuned in a few minutes ago, and I've really tuned in with a couple of the messages that I've just heard about passion and focus, about impact, about unique sort of space. And Surface Against Sewage really has that. We're an organisation that's about people and planet. We're about how people connect with the ocean, the experiences they have around the ocean, whether that's surfing, swimming, whether it's having holidays on the beach here in the UK or abroad, and the sorts of issues that exposes you to and the motivation it gives you to take action. So we work across a range of issues, climate change, plastic pollution, water quality, and the restoration of nature. And this is a really powerful time to do that. It's the UN Decade of the Ocean. And this decade will be crucial to restoring not just our marine ecosystems, but also our terrestrial ecosystems. So for me, my passion started when I was a very small boy. I actually grew up in London, quite near the Thames. And my dad used to take me down to the foreshores of the River Thames. And we used to do a thing called mudlarking, collecting things along the tide line. Of course, London is our greatest ocean city. It is equally as affected by the tides as where I live today in Cornwall. And that's where I really started developing my connection with the marine environment. And then I was passionate about all things that were of our natural world. Later on, I found sports, and this organization represents my two passions, my passion for sport and my passion for the environment. And it brings people into it. I'm a real people person. I like to collaborate with people, empower people. And that's what we do at SAS. We work with over 100,000 volunteers a year around the coastline on things like beach cleans, campaign actions, all sorts of different projects within citizen science as well. We also are in thousands of schools around the country. We reach a million school children in I think about 4,000 schools around the UK with our Plastic Free Schools program. And we have an incredible network of regional leaders in 220 towns and cities on the coastline and inland on rivers and in other environments. So quite a sort of punchy organization that's always been action people have with the environment and the power that can give you, the real experiences that can inform you and take you on a journey. And we like to bring people together on a powerful journey that gives them individual sort of impact, but also connects those voices with the systems around us. We do a lot of work in Parliament. We've got a group called the Ocean Conservation All Party Parliamentary Group, where we bring people together to talk to politicians, talk to ministers, and talk to businesses about the changes that we need to protect the ocean. We're really proud. I think that passion, that authenticity has shone through. We just celebrated our 30th anniversary last year, proudly, and it was just before COVID struck. It was our last event pre-pandemic where we announced our patron, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, came down to take part in that. And we've done a lot of work with the Duke of Cornwall over the past 5 or 6 years. And I think we've got a really unique space and one that continues to shine. We've just come through World Ocean Week in the G7 here in Cornwall. It was quite a sight to behold, and had a whole range of activities, particularly on the ocean and climate emergency. And we staged our biggest ever sort of collective demo. We had about 1,500 people in a mass paddle out in Falmouth, calling for urgent action this decade to protect and restore the ocean that we're all dependent on, whether we live in Cornwall or London or Manchester or any part of the country or world. We all depend on a healthy ocean. Every second breath we take comes from the ocean. Much of our food comes from the ocean. Lots of our innovation comes out of the ocean. And the ocean is the world's climate regulator. So it's vital that we all take action. And I'm really proud to be able to do that through Surface Against Sewage and connect with so many great people.
Thanks, Hugo. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, and then what we do is we move down the panel and we ask for flashing microphones, people flashing mics, and then we'll take some questions from the audience. You mentioned sewage in the 90s, and now obviously plastic is the issue and climate change. How much has that messaging changed, especially for environmentalist campaigners over the years, especially in respect to the ocean?
Yeah, look, it's changed a lot, and the ocean is, of course, the suffers from the impact from lots of different points of view. I mean, the sewage thing's interesting for us. I mean, lots of people ask me whether we should change our name organizationally now. It's probably one of my most asked questions. We've considered it, but it probably wouldn't happen because we've got such good sort of profile and audience sort of share with our name. So we've got a lot of doors it can open. I sometimes compare us to maybe the Carphone Warehouse because no one wants a Carphone anymore, but it's still one of the sort of market leaders. It's reinvented itself by what it does. And so people understand that. And that's what we've done. So we've had to diversify across a lot of different issues. The emerging issues, of course, environmental issues always change. They'll change again in the coming years as unintended consequences of some of the solutions and some of the innovation we see might have a different negative impact too. So these things will always change. But the big issues have changed for us. Back in the 1990s, raw sewage was pumped out into our coastline pretty much continuously. And that's why SAS was founded. And we did a lot of good work putting pressure on water companies, putting a sort of signpost onto the right legislation that needed to be enforced. And so we've seen a lot of improvements around the UK. Sadly, our rivers aren't in such a good state. So those rivers flow to the sea. And last year alone, our rivers were subject to over 3.1 million hours of sewage pollution. That's 8,500 hours every day being pumped into our rivers. And that's why only 14% of our rivers meet good ecological status, which is a woeful indictment of how we're treating our rivers. And we see this decade as a decade to restore those rivers back to full health, places where people can swim, use those blue bodies of water to help their mental health and well-being, their physical health and well-being, all of those things. But plastic pollution is the thing that has really engaged our audiences the most. The sort of plastic that they saw on the tide lines, and we've worked on it for sort of 15 years or so before the Blue Planet effect. But plastic pollution is one of the things that's the sort of touch point. It's the new sewage. The makeup of brands and plastic pollution and litter on our coastline is often very representative of what we see on our high streets, the types of brands and shops we see in our everyday lives. And so there's quite a shocking juxtaposition when we see that on the beach and in the ocean and the damage it's doing. And it empowers people can take action directly through beach cleans. We work with tens of thousands of beach cleaners every year. We've just run our Million Mile Beach Clean with over 70,000 volunteers around the country, which was a brilliant activation. And all of their voices, the sort of data they collect from those beach cleans has helped us change legislation. And that's the really important thing, to stop plastic and these types of pollutants from getting into the environment. So we were instrumental in helping bring in the plastic bag charge. We helped bring in the ban on cotton bud sticks, plastic cotton bud sticks, straws and stirrers. We led the charge on the need for a deposit return system. The government's dragging their feet a little bit on this one. They need to move faster, but they are committed to it. So that should be coming in soon, and that will stop billions of bottles getting into our ocean and onto our beaches and city streets and everywhere else. And so it's been a powerful journey to take people on, one that many of the listeners today will remember from the Blue Planet particularly. And it's interesting because lots of people think of the Blue Planet series back in 2017 as a documentary that was quite focused on plastic pollution. But actually, out of the 7 hours of broadcasting, I think it encompassed, only 14 minutes were dedicated to the issue of plastic pollution. And what a powerful 14 minutes. What a punchy bit of communication that helped change the way governments responded to plastic pollution. Of course, changed how businesses started to respond to their own plastic footprint, and launched activations amongst the public far and wide around the world. We had just launched our Plastic Free Communities project at that stage, just before the Blue Planet, with an ambition to have 100 communities working on that across the UK by 2020. In actual fact, we've got over 800 now. By 2020, we have something like 600 working on that initiative, bringing local charities, local people, local businesses, government together in each sort of the region. So a really powerful way for people to get involved. And some people describe plastic pollution as the gateway sort of issue. It's an issue that gets them to think about their own impact on planet ocean, the types of action they can take to make a difference, how those actions can connect together to change the systems around us, and what lies beyond plastic pollution. Because climate change is very much connected to plastic pollution. Of course, plastic is made out of fossil fuels, which are being, you know, pumped out of the ground around the world. And we need to really think about how we create a more circular system with our plastics. And then the other issues that those impact. So we're in a big decade of ecosystem restoration. And how will we restore our marine and terrestrial environments without action on plastics? Because there's such a flow of plastics into these habitats, and they won't be resilient unless we stop these pollutants, whether it's sewage, plastic, chemicals, or anything else. And so quite a unique issue, because people can see it, they can feel it, they can take action on it every day. You can go to any beach, you can go to any riverbank, you can go to any park and see plastic pollution. And the pandemic has brought even more with it. Plastic face masks are in pretty much every beach setting that I go to these days. I'll see them every time I step out of the door. So it's quite an interesting one. And then this big issue of ocean and sort of climate. We've just come through the G7 summit about 20 miles from where I am now, down in Carbis Bay. We had the world's leaders coming together, the leaders of the seven most sort of influential countries coming together to discuss action coming out of the pandemic. And people want to see a greener, bluer, more sustainable future coming out of this pandemic, a more equitable future. And decisions being made here in Cornwall will help set the course for that. The investments governments can make, the commitment to restoring 30% of our land and sea by 2030, 10 years of action that needs to start today. And then later this year, we've got COP26 in Glasgow in November, the big climate change conference again, where the world will unite with the last best chance to take action on climate change and carbon emissions. So we're in a really interesting time, and I would hazard a guess that we're going to live through the most radical decade of action of environmental restoration, partly because we all want to now. The public is very aligned, aligned with politicians, aligned with businesses. Everyone's starting to point in the same direction, but also because we have to, because our back's against the wall. And we know that we've harmed too much of the planet and we need to restore our equilibrium with the planet. But lastly, because it offers a really great opportunity for a new green sort of business boom of sustainability through the electrification of our grid, through the renewables energy boom, through electric cars, to all of the sorts of things we're going to see come. And people want to see this now. They want to see the results of it. And I don't think people will rest. The sort of the activists out there, the Greta Thunbergs, the Fridays for the Future, the young people in particular, I don't think people will stop until they see the benefits of this, until they see the real impact on the ground. Everyone's talking about planting forests at the moment. They want to see those forests. They need to see them actually growing. They want to be able to set foot in them. They want to be able to interact with these green and blue spaces. They want to see beaches without plastic on them. They want to see marine habitats protected and ring-fenced so they can thrive again. They want to see returning whales and dolphins to the coastline of the whole of the UK and around the world. They want to see the actual results. And it's when they see those results, that they'll start to feel really confident about the future of this beautiful planet that we've all got the great fortune to live and work on together. And there's so much beauty out there to conserve and restore, and nature has the great capacity to rebound and bounce back, particularly in the marine environment. And I think about it down here in Cornwall, because we have, of course, a great mining heritage here, and there's mines, sort of mine ruins everywhere. And it was once the home to this, it was the epicenter of the sort of mining industry in the world. And, you know, some of the richest streets and towns and cities in the country sprung up because of that. Of course, mining is no more on that scale. And all of those ruins are now reclaimed by nature. They are redesignated as outstanding areas of natural beauty. They are areas of special conservation. We see wildlife returning to them, and they are protected, and they are bringing a new economy, an economy that's connected to the natural world, an economy that people can get engaged with. So it's an exciting time, and I'm really optimistic about this decade.
Wow, Hugo, we could take this conversation in so many directions. I could ask you so many questions. I'm going to be selfish and ask you one more, and then we will move on to everybody else. You mentioned Blue Planet, and one documentary that I'm sure has reached, you know, made this again a mainstream issue is Seaspiracy. And I read a really interesting article that you put out there about how they got lots of things right, but also they got some things wrong. So I guess there's two parts of this question. Firstly, how big was Seaspiracy for raising awareness of marine conservation? And secondly, can you touch on the bits that they did get wrong?
Yeah, look, it's a really great question. And what a great documentary that, you know, cut right through you know, all of the noise and maybe sometimes the over analytical and over scientific presentation in many sort of documentaries that doesn't tell a story. It was a brilliant piece of storytelling. It really hit the jugular when it came down to the issue of how we're treating our ocean. I mean, let's not forget that the industrial fishing industry is the last big wild harvest on this planet. We've effectively eaten everything that was wild on the land, and we're now going after everything that's in the ocean. And technology means that is a pretty indiscriminate and devastating industry. I was actually with Ali Tabrizi over the G7. He was down in Cornwall, so he came along to our paddle out. We spent some time together talking about fishing. Ali Tabrizi, for those that don't know, is the director, producer and presenter of Seaspiracy. And we talked about this, and they've gone into they came down to launch a new crowdfunder appeal about the need to protect 30% of our oceans from industrial fishing by 2030. So they've joined other organizations, including SAS, in that call. We need 30% of our land and sea to be highly protected and enforced by 2030. But what did they get wrong? They got wrong, you know, various facts across, or, you know, facts across, or outdated sort of facts, or sort of debunked sort of facts. And I think particularly contentious was that there'll be no more fish in the sea at all by 2048, which I think even the author of the report distanced himself from. But the truth of the film, you know, remains. Industrial fishing is causing havoc to our ocean. Many of the listeners will be sort of shocked to know that, you know, here in the UK and around the world, in marine protected areas, industrial fishing still takes place. In most of them, in almost all of them, we were probably led to believe that marine protected areas actually protect the fish and the life in those areas, but that's not yet the case, and that's what needs to happen. And there's some very damaging fishing practices, of course, longlining that have lots of bycatch of the really big species in our sea, most of which we've already killed, sadly. And then there's a big climate impact of industrial fishing. You've got bottom trawling that releases vast quantities of carbon dioxide, actually more so than the aviation industry. So the seabed is the world's biggest carbon sink, I understand, and bottom trawling is reanimating that sediment, destroying the ecosystem and putting carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. So Ali Tabrizi and the Seaspiracy film have put the sort of the heat under lots of people who are, of course, selfish, people who eat fish, and people who want it as part of their lives. And it's not a binary thing. It's not fishing or no fishing. It's that we've got to stop these big damaging types of industrial fishing that are literally hoovering up all life from the ocean. If you will, and just to give you sort of my thoughts on that, effectively there's these big industries that have monopolized those fish stocks, and they're taking them too quickly. And not only are they destroying the ecosystems, but they're destroying local indigenous and small communities around the world, because they're taking away their livelihoods. And so they're taking away the fish from those communities, but they're also taking away the knowledge of sustainability. Because without the fish, the knowledge of how local fishing communities can harvest sustainably and do things in the right way and actually instinctively react to the you know, diminishing stocks, or have the right reaction to how and where they fish, is being robbed from them. So we're not only seeing this huge damage on taking too many fish too quickly, we're also damaging people, we're damaging knowledge, and we're damaging the way people over centuries or millennia have been able to fish sustainably, because they're in tune with nature, they're in tune with their ocean, they're in tune with local fish stocks. And I think that's a key part of the response. So everyone's now calling for 30% of our ocean to be highly protected by 2030. That's good, and that's what should happen. But we also need to think what needs to happen in the other 70%. The sustainable fishing practices, how people can choose the right fish to eat if they want to eat fish, and how we can help them on that journey. Because, you know, surfacing absolutely isn't telling people to eat or not to eat fish. And I think eating fish is vitally important, and the fishing economy is vitally important to people around the world. Some of us will be very lucky. We can choose not to eat fish if we want to, and that might be a good thing to do. But actually, we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And some of those people who have felt the pressure, some of the other charities who are doing good work, actually need to be supported. So I'm not one that would advocate this sort of calling out of these other charities. They might be getting things wrong themselves. Their sustainability marks might not be good enough yet. They might need reform. They might need to be better. But those organizations have got a head start, and they need to use the pressure from this film to actually do that, to go 70% of our sea needs to be used sustainably if 30% is being highly protected. And how can we play our part in that? And that's the question we've got to answer after Seaspiracy. And it's great to see the passion from it. It's great to see the impact and the cut through the film's had. I think some stakeholders out there are probably annoyed. They've been talking about these things for years. They probably put out documentaries and films themselves that haven't cut through. And there'll be an element, I suspect, of jealousy from some quarters, because it's managed to tap in to a real public sentiment and real support for the need to protect our ocean. And it has told a true story, albeit at times in a clunky way. You know, it's told a true story of us taking too much from the ocean. And not doing, not implementing sustainability in the way that we might have been told. So, a powerful time. And Ali, it was great to see him down here in Cornwall around the G7. He came to our paddle out. It was a brilliant moment. Got to see lots of our supporters there. And I think he was taken with our approach of empowering people, of giving people the tools to take action. And the sort of noise we can make as quite a small organization, the sorts of people that we've been able to reach over our 30-year history to create change, because it's through the systemic changes of the big players at G7 or COP26 or within government here or abroad that we will change the world around us over this decade.
Brilliant. Thanks, Hugo. Something's going to make... I feel that we're going to have lots of questions here. We've already getting questions coming in via the means that we use in the background of people that wish to submit questions. But I'm going to move through some of the speakers, if that's okay. And we're going to try and take as many questions as we can. So if we can have some... the answers are absolutely fantastic, by the way. But if we can keep them short, sure. So we can pipe through the questions, because I think we're going to have a lot of them. Ashley, are you there?
Yes. So... great interview so far there, Hugo, and thanks for letting me ask a question. So my question around this would be, how do we wake up the big businesses to take action on this sort of stuff?
Good question. Look, in short, I think they are waking up. I think they realize they have to wake up. We work with some really good business leaders who are, you know, putting their words into action, whether it's on plastic or on sustainable fish or anything else. So, you know, they are listening. It's up to us to keep up the pressure. But I think that, you know, what I'm seeing out there is probably going to be pretty sort of revolutionary. So I think we're at the start of a really exciting decade of innovation within business, and we need them. We need their expertise in supply chains, in product development, in engineering to do this. Because, of course, we're the activists and campaigners. We don't have all of that, but we can point out the issues and we can have a really progressive and constructive conversation about it with them and with the government. Needs to set the level playing field for businesses to take action in the right way too. So it's a combination of all of these components, but I see some really encouraging signs. You know, if you want to, read a book about sort of business approach. Our chairman, Richard Walker, has written a great book about corporate disruption. Have a look at that. It's called The Green Grocer.
The Green Grocer, yeah. Brilliant. Thank you for that answer. And, yeah, good answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ash. Yeah, Richard was here as a guest a couple of weeks ago, Hugo. He was
great, yeah.
James, do you have a question?
I do indeed. It's going to be a bit of a weird one, so hopefully the context makes sense. Hugo, great interview so far, and I love the work that you've been doing. I've been aware of your brand for a number of years.
Thank you.
Has activism and environmentalism been weakened by the growth of social media? And by what I mean by that is, you know, anyone can now go to a beach and go, hashtag, you know, save the oceans, look, there's a plastic bag, but not actually pick the damn thing up. You know, there's a lot of sort of virtue signaling rather than action taking. So is this sort of the influence of social media helping to raise issues, or has it conversely weakened the issues because any Tom, Dick and Harry can throw their ring into the hat without actually having a substantial level of knowledge around the genuine issue?
I think with anything, there's good and bad. I think we've reached many more people. We reach more people than ever before at Surface Against Sewage. There's no doubt about that. We collaborate with people around the world because of social media. We connect with people just as we are right now because of social, and, you know, other platforms like Twitter and Instagram have been really powerful for us to create new conversations and actual projects and impact with people. So, you know, I'm confident that the net benefits of social media are good in terms of, you know, awakening a new movement of activists that complements the boots we see on the ground. When I started at SAS back in 2008, the organization was in a very bad place. Rickety was about to fold, actually. And we would have been mobilizing maybe 500 people a year, at beach cleans and other things, maybe 1,000. But today it's, 100,000 people that are joining us on the ground, hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, who are taking digital actions with us. And those can be signing petitions, writing letters to politicians. We've got a water quality app called the Safer Sea Service. Do have a look at it if you want. And there's a tool within that. Every time there's a sewage spill at one of 380 locations included in that, an activist, a subscriber, can send a message directly to the CEO of that water company going, this isn't good enough. This is what's happened. Well, what are you going to do about it? And start a conversation. So there's some really good things. There's a lot of slacktivists out there who probably just want to do the virtue signaling too. But we need to probably just ignore those and get on with the people who really want to take action. But yeah, good question.
Amazing. Thanks very much. Keep up the great work, because we, us slacktivists, need people like you who are generally making a difference. So thank you for the work that you do.
Thanks,
I appreciate
so much.
It.
Thank you.
Right, guys, can you flash your microphones if you have a question, please? I'm going to move through these as quick as I can. So I'm going to come to Lucien and then John. Lucien.
Good morning. Thank you, Hugo, for coming and spending time with us. It's great to have you here. I'm a water baby, born in Germany. We spent a lot of time in natural lakes swimming about. And in the UK, it's something that I've seen growing as a wild water phenomenon in the last few years. What can we do to ensure that we're swimming in places that have got clean water? Is there a way of us testing it? You mentioned a survey that you've got there, just so that people in the UK who are spending more time swimming in wild water are as safe as they can be?
Well, look, yeah, it's a great question. And our Safer Seas service has become the Safer Seas and River Service this year, and we're adding a number of river spots in the UK to help give people the right information about when and where there may be pollution or is pollution, and so they can avoid that and swim in the cleanest possible place. The Rivers Trust are doing lots of good work on this too, and have information about river water quality. I would say to you, look, we totally recognize there's been a boom in wild and open water swimming, in paddle boarding, in kayaking on our rivers, and these are blue spaces that are vital to the health of communities nationwide. Indeed, our towns and cities were built on rivers because of the benefits those rivers brought. So it's a shocking thing that we're putting so much pollution into them. And I see this decade to sort of, I'd really hope it's going to mirror what happened in the 1990s on our coastline, where we really helped improve the water quality on our coastline. I think we went from something like 27% of our beaches passing the minimum standards to now 98%, which is, you know, a great legacy that we've been able to deliver. We want to see the same on our rivers this decade. So, you know, tune into the Safer Seas and Rivers Service, and that will start to give you information at different spots. And we're hopeful to help deliver probably hundreds of river bathing water spots by the end of this decade. It's going to take time. It's a complex issue, but the journey starts today.
Wonderful. Thanks for your work, Hugo. Cheers, Paul. All right,
thank you.
Thanks, Lucy. And John.
Hi, Hugo. Good
morning,
to see you.
John. Good to
yeah, see you. It's just reminded me how long overdue a pint and a chat is, actually.
Absolutely.
Great to hear this. I'm not really got a question. I'm going to get out of the way of other people who will have, but I would just say this to everybody in the audience. A lot of people come on Clubhouse and go to other rooms because they want to learn about brand, they want to learn about mobilising people, they want to learn about getting impact. Go and have a look at Surfers Against Sewage website. Look at the creativity. Look at the way that brand has been built, where Hugo talked about, is there a need to change the name? No, because it doesn't matter if we're plastics or anything else. It's all the crap we produce as humans. And the big message is that if nature's given a chance, it'll recover. We all have the ability to pick something up and do those little things. And, you know, you've heard me say this before. Some people say, but it's only a drop in the ocean. But if we all put our drops together, we'll become the ocean. Hugo, great to see you here.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you, John. Yeah, I'll see you soon. Just to give a quick response to that, I think also, you know, I'm really grateful for those kind words, John. And I think it's really important that you do sort of know your brand and your audience, and you know what your focus is, where that comes from, the passion and authenticity, and you know the sort of unique space you're operating in. I always sort of think that, you know, that you always want to grow your audience, you want to empower as many people as possible, but you can't necessarily be all things to all people, and you've got to know what you're good at, what you want to achieve, and create things for as many people as possible to come on that journey with you. That USP is really important, that unique way of operating, and knowing your brand, your campaign, your product is so important, and I hope we're getting that right. And if you've not seen it just to this point, please do go and check out our film Thank You Sea, which we released last week, made by the award-winning filmmaker Tom Mustill, which is a very emotional, sort of beautiful film about how important the sea is to us and to everyone. Do check it out. It's on our website.
Thanks, John. I actually watched that film last night, Hugo, and what was shocking to me was just the percentage of the sea that you mentioned, a stat that comes up, doesn't it, on the video about the percentage of the sea that's actually protected, which was an eye-opener to me. Right, guys, flash your microphones if you have some questions. We also have some that have come in the background, so I'm going to take one more and then go to some of the ones that have come in the background and then go back to people in the audience. Anna.
Thank you so much, Paul. Thank you for bringing Hugo. Ashley, thanks for having me. Hugo, congrats on everything that you're doing. It's amazing. And I definitely will also watch the movie that you mentioned. My question to you is the following. I was on a panel last week with Marty Kollner, who's a major music producer. And there were a few scientists on the panel. And it just referenced back to a conversation I've had with other scientists about 10 years ago on the Harvard Women's Leadership Board where I was serving. And at the time, it was stated that we had about 50 years to save the planet environmentally. And when I brought that statistic up, one of the scientists brought up the fact that we have now, it's predicted less than even 30 years, less than that. And that by 2030, it is predicted that there will be about 2 billion refugees, environmental refugees that will be displaced around the planet. Mm-hmm. So I was curious to know if you're working with other scientists, other activists to solve this on a global level. And what are your thoughts about this? Thank you. I'm Anna and I'm complete for now.
Yeah, look, a really good question. I mean, just to your point on working with other people, we are collaborating all the time with different scientists on organizations on different threats. We were one of the founding members of a conference called the Global Wave Conference with organizations like Wild Coast and Surfrider in the US, and many organizations here, the National Trust and others, World Animal Protection. So lots of different people that come together to talk about what we need to do. There's so many converging issues at the moment. And to come back to this point of protecting nature, we need wild, thriving nature for us to exist in our wild, thriving communities and with the society as we have it. And what we're probably talking about is trying to protect our society as it is today. We're not talking really about protecting the planet, because the planet's going to be fine without us, and it will reconstitute everything. And nature and wildlife always wants to find equilibrium. And it's whether we can make sure that we're in our biggest possible way part of that equilibrium, because nature will find a way to deliver it otherwise. So I think the timeframes probably are more urgent than those 50 years in terms of starting action. And I do think that this is the year to start that. And we need to see, you know, things that are pretty bold and radical to deliver the changes we want to see. We know that business as usual is killing planet ocean. You know, every metric points towards that. We've got pockets of success stories and hope where we see wildlife recovering, where we see fish stocks bouncing back, all of those sorts of things. And that's good. And we need to use that science. We need to listen to that science to sort of map out the route map for where we need to go. So we do need to, you know, radically shift how we do things. The renewable energy boom is going to really be a big help in that, in terms of creating circularity and giving us abundant, clean, green energy, all of those things. But we do need to act fast. So collaboration is key. We can't do it by ourselves. We can't do it on our own. We need to have partnerships, the right partners. We need to have shared goals. We need to be bold given we're getting most things wrong right now in terms of protecting the planet, we need to try really new things to get it right. I am hopeful. I think it's an enduring human quality, hope, and we'll all have hope until our, you know, last breath in many ways. And so we need to use our time to be able to re-engineer, you know, what we're doing on the planet. And we're proud to play our part in that alongside many other brilliant organizations and business leaders and community members around the UK and around the world.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the question, Anna. So I'm going to come to some of the questions that we've had coming in the background, and then I'm going to continue to move down the panel. So Melissa, you reached out. You have a question.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I'm so excited to see you up there, Hugo. Firstly, congratulations on getting 1,000 people into the water down in Cornwall. That's just amazing. So basically, I'm the co-founder. Some people know, I have my own business, but I'm the co-founder of SUP Wales. We started a year ago yesterday, so it was our birthday with my brother, Julian.
And happy birthday.
Thank you. And we've got a growing community now, so we're very much about sort of paddleboarding. But, you know, like you said, it's about people and planet. So we're in Wales. Business Wales are encouraging sort of the new businesses to obviously work towards sort of an eco badge with them. True environmental policies in place, and to show them that you've done things and initiatives that show that, you know, you're worthy of that. So what is happening at the moment is, for example, we're partnering with people, but we're sort of asking them, you know, what their environmental policies are. And if they don't have them or they don't have initiatives, then we can't partner with them. So for example, if they want us to promote products for them, even down to the ink on the t-shirts, we're being quite stringent in making sure that if we are partnering with people that, you know, as much as we can be, I mean, we've still got a lot to learn on this, Hugo. And I just, you know, I think when you were talking and John was talking and you were saying about the corporates, you know, that is the long game to get everybody to change. But I get that the contracts are already, they're so already in bed with a lot of the long-term contracts they have that it's difficult. So I love that Business Wales are starting to sort of get newer businesses on board to say, right, okay, what policies are you going to put in place now? But I just thought there's a lot of business leaders that may not have thought about sustainability on this in this room today. So what advice would you give to sort of setting up policies or anything that you can advise to help us, please? Thank you.
Yeah, look, I think it's important to have sort of a due diligence around who you're partner with, and to understand the impacts they may have. You know, there's a lot of talk about green and blue these days, of companies not doing enough and purely sort of getting involved on a marketing basis rather than actually taking action. But you know, that said, I'd be careful and be cautious about letting the sort of perfect getting in the way of actually creating new relationships and sort of starting journeys with people, because often the initial steps are the sort of conversation starter, and then you can work over a period of time to improve how businesses are taking action and how they're reforming. It will take time. It does take time. And so there's green and blue washing, but then there's also people doing what they can given their resources, and that can be good, and that does add up. So we are careful with you know, who we partner with at Surface Against Sewage, and we have a, you know, corporate due diligence policy, but we don't expect everyone to be perfect within it, and none of us are, and we'll all have an impact every day. You know, we all have an impact every day we wake up, and so we've got to be careful to take people with us and not let, as it were, the dark green or dark blue expectations actually put people off and put people off from coming along.
Wow, that's brilliant advice. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa. Louise, I'm not sure if you're there. Are you there with your question?
I am, but I'm driving. If you could ask it for me.
Okay, bear with me. I'll come back to that one. I'll get the question up in front of me and come back to you. Richard, are you there?
Yes, Paul, I'm here. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. How's things? And good morning, Hugo. Yeah, fantastic to have you here. I'm Richard. I've got the sky in the background down below. I've spent a lot of my life in, around, under the water. My day job is for the HM Coast Guard. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just fantastic to hear you speak. What I'm really interested in, and this is more of a personal question to yourself, Hugo, is we talked a lot about impact. I'm really interested in the effect that being around in or on the sea has on people from a well-being perspective. Yeah. And one thing that I often am asked is, what is it about the sea? You know, how does the sea make you feel? So can you put that into words for you? What is it about being out in the surf, you know, that connection? Could you put that into words in any way, how special that is for you?
Yeah, look, great question, Richard. And I appreciate the question. What does it do for me? Well, it's a hugely sort of special and wonderful environment to sort of plunge into. I feel sort of a childlike sort of excitement every time I set foot from the sand into the water. I surfed at lunchtime yesterday, and I went swimming with my son Darwin. He's 13. Yesterday evening, we went on an open water swim around Mayenporth Beach in Falmouth, through schools of sand eels. There were wrasse, there were various fish around, beautiful seaweed sort of forests as well, kelp and other things. I find it sort of sheds a lot of the structures of our modern lives. You know, you even sort of shed your sort of digital sort of structures, and you get into the water, and it's such a special experience. And surfing specifically, I think there is something sort of quite spiritual, without being corny. I don't want to get all sort of all point break on this, but you are in the ocean, you are aligning your sort of energy with energy that has come often from a storm many miles away onto that one wave or few waves that you managed to get in position for. Right, it's a fleeting sort of liquid beauty that is a once only offer. Each wave you get is a once only offer, and you have to work pretty hard for that. A lot of surfing happens when not surfing. It's about how you focus your mind and relationship with a spot or various spots to be able to get into the sea, to know when it's working, the tide, the wind, the size of the swell, the period on that swell, all sorts of different things. And so you have to work quite hard. And for me, that is the risk and reward. Everything good in life comes from working hard and really investing in it. You need, if it comes too easily and for free, then what's its value? And so there's a real value in those days. And it's the same in the ocean. You know, the beautiful days, we're just going through a beautiful run at the moment of very still, flat water on the south coast, some good waves on the north coast here in Cornwall, beautiful sunshine, the right conditions. But I go through many days when the wind is howling 50 miles an hour, the rain's pouring down, it's freezing cold, and you can't surf and you can't really do anything. And so it's about that reward. There's a sort of osmosis, I think, of the stresses and strains it pulls out of you as you get into the water. We all sort of came from the water. We're made of, 70% water, 80% water, I don't know. There's a distinct part of that I can feel stresses dripping away. And we live in a pretty pressurized world. I'm thankful to run something that I love, but it's still very high pressure to do. And so it's a true release. Hopefully that answers it in part.
Absolutely brilliant, Hugo. Thank you. And I feel very much that feeling is the way to get people engaged with the ocean. And Obviously the spin-off to that is the conservation. Would I be right in saying that?
Yeah, look, lots of people say that, and there is lots of science. I mean, I'd recommend you look at the European Centre for the Environment and Human Health, and a guy I've worked with, a guy called Dr. Matt White, has done lots of work on the benefits of the blue environment to our physical and mental health. So I'd look them up. A great organization. We've done lots of work on antibiotic resistance with them too, in the sort of water. And so I'd agree with you. I think it's a particularly powerful example of where the environment brings us those benefits, but I wouldn't say it's the only one, because I think there's benefits and a sort of a freedom in other spaces. I mean, even kids getting together to play football on a bit of sort of parkland or wasteland can bring real benefits and joys and a release. So I think, I think that there's all sorts of examples of it where we become focused enough in the environment to distract us from other things that allow us to be ourselves, that allow our mind to sort of reconnect the right synapses and allow us to be happier, healthier and more productive.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Hugo. Yeah, I'm going to definitely connect with you offline.
So, Hugo, Louise, who I did come to, submitted a question. She's driving. So she has a salon, and they recycle 90% of their salon waste. They use the hair to make brooms and soak up oil spills in the sea. And what she's asking is, what other organisations can they join to help the oceans?
Yeah, look, that's amazing. 90%, recycling, reuse. So great work, Louise. That's impressive stuff, and so good that you're thinking about it like this. Actually, we've got the Plastic Free Awards tomorrow night in Bristol, and I think we've got a hairdresser doing lots of sustainable things who are shortlisted in one of the categories. So there's clearly a movement afoot. What I would say to anyone is find the organization that you feel is most in tune with you and your values and the action you want to sort of take. There are some very practical organizations that empower individuals to, reduce their plastic footprint or live a lower carbon lifestyle, those sorts of things. And then there's many sort of political organizations that call for change, the Greenpeaces, the Friends of the Earth, those sorts of organizations, and others that span both, like Surfers Against Sewage. So find the organization that really appeals to you, whether that's local, national or international, and collaborate with them, give them your voice, have a conversation with them and see where you can take that. Many organizations really benefit, of course, from financial support, but they're most probably interested in these days in getting you involved in their sort of movement building, because that's what needs to happen this decade. So yeah, loads of good things happening, particularly in this ocean decade, and all sorts of organizations at many scales. I particularly like that, you know, local community movements myself. I see so much power in that, and it's all of those movements coming together that actually enable the national and international shift. So never overlook the acting local and how that influences the global debate.
Brilliant. Thanks, Hugo. How are you for time? Are we okay to take a few more questions?
I'm all good.
Cool. Right. Flash your microphones, guys, if you have a question. And I'll just move down the panel. I'm going to go to Ryan.
Thanks, Paul. Good morning, Hugo. And thank you for being here and sharing your wonderful words with everybody. So I heard you say earlier about we could potentially go to our local beaches and rivers and clear up some plastic and rubbish, etc. However, that's not always possible. So what action steps can we as individuals implement into our daily lives, literally like today, possibly with, say, our shopping habits, etc.?
Yeah, look, it's a really good question. And we're conscious that not everyone can, you know, take part in a beach clean or a river clean. You know, sadly, wherever we are, that there will always be plastic pollution of some type. But, you know, I get it that in urban environments particularly, it's probably less appealing. In fact, it's probably not appealing at all to go out and do a litter pick in quite the same way as on the beaches of Cornwall. But we can all take action. And I mean, you can take action, you know, digitally, and we talked a bit about the pros and cons of the social media world, but you can also take action and challenge brands. We do a thing called Return to Offender. It started back in sort of 2007, where we'd find branded packaging on beaches and we'd send it back to the companies using their free post address, which means that they ultimately pay for that returning of the litter. And we had a whole sort of set of questions about what those companies were doing to reduce their impact on the planet. Started some really good conversations with people like Coca-Cola about their packaging waste and plastic pollution. And we morphed that into a thing on Twitter where people would take pictures of the plastic pollution they saw and challenge the brands by handling them into it. And you can look this up with the Return to Offender hashtag. So some quite interesting stuff there. But day to day, you know, we can all have we can all choose, you know, what we consume. We've talked about fish in terms of diet. People can choose to have a meat and fish free day or a couple of days or week every month, which can help. You can choose a lower plastic sort of or less plastic products. You can have a bamboo toothbrush. You can refill your coffee cup and take a coffee cup out and about with you, or water bottle. You can do all of these things, which, you know, in their own way might not change the world just from that one action, but they can empower you to think about this more and reduce your own personal plastic footprint. So yeah, lots of different things you can do. We can't all be perfect every day with it, because plastic is all around us and there's a supply chain impact from any product we have, you know, whether it's a piece of cod that you might choose to eat, or whether it's an avocado or a banana or potatoes grown here in the UK. So there's always an impact, but you can think about how to reduce that impact.
Thank you, Hugo. Yeah, I love that. Thanks so much.
I think, David, are you there?
Yeah, my wife just phoned me just as I was there. So great. This is a great conversation and great questions by everybody, Hugo. I'm privileged enough to live in Liverpool, and before that lived in Southport. So I had Ainsdale Beach, which was one of the best beaches. And I currently live 5 minutes away from Crosby Beach.
Yeah.
And I go cold water swimming every day. If you check out my Instagram, I've been in all weathers. My question is, when I go, I take one of those rings and pick up the litter myself. Are there any organisations where you can get other people, like volunteers, as like a central database where you can like create a movement so more people come and do what I'm doing? Or, you know, rather than just doing a Facebook post, so rather than just having 10 or 20 of your friends who will say they'll come up and then about 5 turn up, is there anywhere where you can actually get like-minded people, or is there a central place where I could put a post on or something and say, right, guys, on this particular day, I'm going to be at Crosby Beach, let's all just sweep the beach, because I do that anyway. And the amount of plastic, and also those gas canisters, because people do drugs and they do the balloons. So what is there anything like that which I can go and put a post on or anything about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, and you see those gas canisters everywhere now, don't you? And how times change. Listen, it's a good question. There are organisations, and you know, SAS is one of those. So we actually have, I think, regional reps in your area, David. So we can connect you with them. And those are people who are taking action the whole time and helping organise things. I think many groups organise sort of regular sort of picks. So whether that's weekly, monthly or quarterly, there's people who do that. So there are groups. So, yeah, drop us a line and we can connect you with the regional rep in your area and start a conversation there. We're doing our Million Mile Beach Clean, which has been so popular so far. I think we're already at 800,000 or 900,000 miles, and we've got the rest of the year to go. And we'd really encourage you to sort of register through that too. My team sends out incredible kits to lead volunteers to help support those local efforts. It's been very popular. It helps bring people together. Our whole, you know, we started the conversation about sort of passions for people, for the planet, and sport and people. And we really are a people and planet charity. And, you know, what you've articulated to me is, you know, exactly what we want to see. It's not always easy. I've done a few things, David, beach cleans where, you know, the weather might be less good than people had anticipated, and we end up five of us on the beach or three of us on the beach. Equally, I've, you know, done many beach cleans with hundreds of people. And it's always an undulating sort of response. There's never consistent in what you'll find sort of everywhere. But I think that the key is to keep on keeping on, and you can connect your efforts with us online. Million Mile Beach Clean hashtag, Surfers Against Sewage hashtag. All of those things can help bring you into the community with us too, and help connect you with other people. So yeah, various routes there, David.
That's great. I'll connect with you on Instagram, because I get my kids involved as well. Like I'm passing it on to my little girl, and she puts the gloves on and picks it up, and she says, "Is this a good bit of plastic, Dad?" And I say, "Yeah, that's a good bit." And she gets involved in it. So I'm already creating the framework for when she's older to be conscious of, you know, what we're doing to the planet. So yeah, I'll DM you on Instagram if that's okay, Hugo.
Great. I'll wait to hear from you. Thank you.
Brilliant. Right, guys, let's get through as many as we can. Flash your mics here. Lilana.
Hi, thank you. Great conversation. Thank you so much. And just thanks for all of the work that you've done, Hugo. I work in navigating sustainability for businesses and corporates. And I just, the diaspora of the work that you've done is just huge in terms of mobilising communities. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm going to ask for some resources. I am frustrated, I think, with the disconnect with the government's, not just the government's, but just in general, the commitments that they're making, for instance, for the HMPAs, which is the Highland Marine Protection. They're looking to do that. And at the same time, we've got, and then we've got wind farms. I'm on the Kent coast. We've got wind farms that our seal populations, for instance, have gone up as a sort of byproduct of the protection by the wind farms. And then you see these huge sort of cruise liners just very close to shoreline and things. But I actually think there's a case for some areas in this particular area to receive funding to become a sort of sustainability hub with investment, and that be its sort of USP for its regeneration. And I just wondered if you had any examples of that. Obviously, I look at Costa Rica and, you know, and everywhere, but in the UK, is there any where it ticks all of the sustainability, people, planet, profit?
Look, I think just a few points there. You know, interestingly, you know, of course, the highly protected marine areas, for those that don't know, is sort of the step up now from marine protected areas. The government last week announced on World Ocean Day their intent to pilot some highly protected marine areas around the country in the coming sort of 24 months to identify them and to set those into motion. And these areas are proven to be, you know, really good for wildlife. There's a good example on Lundy Island in North Devon, where it's highly protected from industrial fishing and damaging activities. And the wildlife there is incredible and has a spillover effect in into the areas next door to it, particularly on things like lobsters. They're bigger, there's more of them, and then in areas just outside the highly protected marine area, they are also more abundant. So, you know, these are good, and of course then good for local economies too, and the local sustainable fishing practices. So I think there are examples where, you know, those things come together. Lundy is a good example of where tourism has come in, you know, too, and done good things. Just to take a couple of points there, interesting you mentioned wind farms. There's, of course, controversy about those too in terms of some of the damaging impacts on wildlife or potential damaging impacts. But also within a wind farm area, once it's constructed, there is then no more fishing, no more other activities, and that can be beneficial to wildlife and give refuges for fish, and there are examples of that too. In terms of funding, the government have also launched just last week the Blue Planet Fund. I think it's $500 million for initiatives here and abroad to help the ocean recover. So you might want to have a look at that and see how that applies to your potential projects. But the truth is, and there are examples in Costa Rica and Mexico and around the world, that where we highly protect the ocean, after initial challenge with you know, maybe people not being able to fish or do other activities, actually the net benefits are incredible to the local community, to wildlife, and to people. And that's the important thing. And how do we get there? And we need to take everyone with us on that journey. It's important to have the right conversations with the fishing community, the right conversations with local people, and really bring together everyone who it stands to win from putting the right things in place. So going back to our point of collaboration, I think all of these initiatives really have a fundamental need to bring people together, get the right opinions and the opinions of local people and the sustainable industries we want to see on our coastline and want to see coming back to some of our impoverished areas of the UK coastline. We need to have those conversations. So yeah.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
Right, guys, flash your microphones, please, just so I can get through the last questions. Pete Cohen, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much, Paul. I've had internet issues this morning that have made me have to come in and out. Hugo, you're amazing. You are fantastic. You're a real superhero.
Thank you.
In my eyes. And, you know, the most popular films at the moment are definitely those superheroes where people come together and they ask the questions, you know, how can we work together to collaborate? I just wanted your opinion about a couple of things. Southampton Hospital, I've been working with the executive team there, and I couldn't believe this when the chief medical officer was telling me that some of the biggest health problems they have in that region is all to do with people's issues with their lungs and toxicity, and it has a lot to do with the cruise liners, that they don't turn their engines off when they're in port.
Yep.
And there's an initiative, but the government won't back it.
Oh, I've lost you, Pete.
That's what happens when someone calls you. There's an initiative for the government for electricity for the boats, so they don't have to have their engines on. And it just seems so crazy that such a simple solution. But I just wondered what your opinion is about this. So I think in the world at the moment, one of the biggest problems is people saying that's not my problem. I'm right, you're wrong. I'm red, you're white, you're this, I'm that. Rather than truly, I mean, it sounds like a utopia, but surely the answer is that we look at all of this and think this is all of our problem. It's my problem, it's my solution, and I have to be involved in this.
Yeah.
I just wanted your opinion about that. And have you heard of the Terra Carta, you know, this thing with Prince Charles?
Yeah.
Again, I put something together around that because I think it's a very interesting initiative, and I wondered if you've got any opinion about that, but I appreciate we haven't got much time and we could probably talk about this for the next 6 months.
Yeah. So, look, the Terra Carta is a great initiative, and Prince Charles is our patron. I've done a lot of work with him over the past sort of 5 or 6 years, really. I mean, he's been talking about this stuff for 30, 40 years. He's very progressive in this space, and the Terra Carta is a great initiative and one that the SAS supports. I had a good conversation with the team behind it just a couple of weeks ago. So we're on shipping. Absolutely, that's an issue and one that needs to be tackled. I'm sort of surprised in some ways to hear that it's such a big issue in that area in terms of the health of the local community. And we'd sort of urge action on that. You don't want big boats idling in any sort of harbour, just burning fuel and polluting the local environment. I think probably to your point, I mean, I would look at other sort of crises as we come out of the pandemic. I'm particularly aware of the mental health impacts that this pandemic has had. And that's one of the reasons we launched a Million Mile Beach Clean, to get people back outside and back together as we emerge from the pandemic, to try and help them do something good for their mind, do something good for their body, and do something good for the ocean. And that's important to me. I see around me a sort of a pandemic of mental illness, you know, people really struggling with the pressures of life, struggling coming out of the pandemic. And I think the blue space can be good for that. We've talked about it already. There's lots of science that points towards this. And I think bringing people together by the beach, you know, in the water, to do a good environmental activity is a very powerful way of doing this, and we hope that sort of blue prescriptions will sort of come more and more, as I know they have. There've been green prescriptions trialed before, and we need to see sort of more of this. So absolutely we need to tackle the shipping. Absolutely we need to think about big businesses having an impact on local communities. We've talked about it in the fishing context, we're talking about it in the shipping context. I would say probably the cruise liner industry hasn't fared particularly well during the pandemic. I think that it's a microcosm of the problem. I mean, a very large number of people on a relatively small boat, all sharing limited resources, it's not a great calling card around the pandemic. So maybe it won't be emitting so much just because of that too.
Well, thank you for everything you do. If I can do anything to help and support you in any way, I'll send you a message. I've got a
thanks so much, Pete.
Community of people. If there's anything, obviously I can see what you're doing, and there's lots of things we can all do, but I really appreciate you. I've seen a TED talk that you did, and I was hugely moved by you and what you're doing. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Pete. Yeah, appreciate that.
Thanks, Pete. Sharon, coming to you.
Hi, thank you very much. And Hugo, thanks so much for today. You're really speaking my language. But what I wanted to ask you is, I actually created a film myself last year about the pandemic and about, you know, what the world looked like before the pandemic, what it looked like during, and what it could potentially look like after. And it had this environmental thread based on the fact that I felt there was a glimpse for environmental change. And whilst I appreciate that the plastics have escalated as a result, do you think that we've had time for pause, time for reflection? Do you think that the public kind of mental psyche has changed in terms of how they view the environment as a result of the pandemic?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. And absolutely, I do. I think people realise how important the wild world is to them. I've seen, this sort of outpouring. You know, we've all been locked down over the past 18 months for various periods of time. And during that time, people have realized how much they missed nature. They missed their rivers, their parks, the ocean, the beach. We did some surveying in the first lockdown about exactly that across the public. And the beach and the ocean came out top of the areas people want to miss. And we've talked a bit today about, if people are connected and exposed to their environment, if they love their environment, they'll do stuff to protect it. And that's an age old saying, people will protect what they love. And I do think it applies. And it's up to us to create the tools for them to be able to do that, to be able to turn the passion into action, to put the pressure in the right places to protect their local environments around the country and around the world. But we've got a lot of work to do to change the systems around us, because we're all sort of trapped in an economic, a carbon, a plastic, a consumption system. We can all sort of move ourselves around within that to a degree, but we've also got to connect to make sure that the systems are protecting those spaces that we rely on. And people often forget, You know, we rely on thriving wild nature. We don't rely on sort of managed nature and manicured nature. We rely on it being abundant and rich and diverse with all of the specialist organisms that we need. Because it's not just the big charismatic things that we like, whether it's the whales or the eagles. It's the worms and the bugs and the bacteria and all of the things that come together to create this powerhouse of a machine, the best machine that's ever existed on the planet, which is nature, which is always looking to deliver equilibrium. It's always collaborating with each other. Everyone's always got a specialism within nature to deliver and to support others. So it's a really interesting time. And I think people have had an environmental awakening. And what I'm seeing today is sort of unprecedented, even compared to 2 or 3 years ago, in terms of the public sentiment, the business sentiment, and the political sort of will and sentiment growing. And so I'm really sort of ambitious that we'll be able to protect those spaces.
Thank you, Hugo. How can we get involved with your organisation in any way we want to? Is there anything that we can do?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, come to our website. You know, there's lots of actions that you can take sort of through that. Whether it's joining a community in your area for beach cleans, river cleans, park cleans, whether it's taking action with us at campaign sort of demos, as it were, like our big paddle out in Falmouth. G7. You can take practical action. We do lots of citizen science on microplastics, on water quality testing. And we do lots sort of politically connecting people on petitions. We've got our ocean and climate petition. We're going to be taking that forward with some youth leaders to COP26 in Glasgow in November. So lots of different things. Please do, you know, get in touch, you know, drop me a message. And happy to signpost you and have a conversation.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Right, guys, so I think we're going to take one, maybe two, if we're quick, questions. So flash your microphones so I can see who's got to talk. Right, okay, I'm going to go for Alan and then Megan, and that's probably going to be it. So, Alan, go for it.
Thanks, Paul, and thank you, guys, for putting this on. Hugo, I'm a big fan of your organization. I'm a surfer that grew up in South Africa. I've surfed around the world, including Cornwall. And I'm just curious, I'm always fascinated by people who do the kind of work you do, about how do you... I mean, sometimes, you know, I remember growing up in Durban, South Africa, when I used to paddle out and the water was so clean and so clear. I mean, the visibility was incredible. And nowadays, you know, obviously that's not the same way anywhere you go and surf. And what do you do to, you know, when you look around and you see the work you're doing and you see what's going on in the world, how do you keep yourself like in a great state of mind? I mean, what do you do for yourself? Because, I mean, sometimes, you know, doing the work I do, I look around and sometimes I think, oh my gosh, it's like such a, It's like such hard work to keep doing what we're doing, you know, to create consciousness shift. What do you do for yourself to keep yourself in that great state and keep plugging away?
Yeah, look, that's a really great question. Look, I still find a massive amount of joy and positivity from the ocean. I see I was swimming down on the Roseland Peninsula yesterday, day before yesterday, in beautiful sparkling water. I swam by myself. There was no one around, at a little horseshoe cove, hundreds of different types of plants and animals sort of around me. I mean, the kelp forest I swam through was just so beautiful and the water was crystal clear. And I find great, joy in that. I feel really positive about riding waves and the experiences that brings me. You know, I see, you know, we don't have big wildlife down here that much, but, you know, basking sharks and seals and, of course, bird life that I see, you know, around me when I'm surfing, and I feel really positive about that. I feel really positive about people who share this drive. I learn a lot from people around me, business leaders, surfers, environmentalists, campaigners, activists. You know, I listen to them, I hear their stories, I get informed all the time. And I do see a lot of beauty still in the world. We're in, you know, the part of the G7 summit was a visit to, you know, Newquay Airport, where they've got this new spaceport sort of plan. And people are looking, of course, for, you know, exploration across the solar system, the galaxy, whatever. And people talk about getting to Mars and trying to find signs of previous life. I mean, if we flew a space mission and found a planet in the state that our planet is in today, we'd be over the moon. We'd see it as teeming with life and so worth protecting, and we'd be it would be incredible. So we are on that planet now. Let's do everything we can to protect and restore it. There is still time, there is still hope, and I think there are plenty of indications that show that if we give nature the space to rebound, it will recover and do all of the things that we need it to do to remain a thriving and prosperous community of organisms on the planet.
Fabulous. Thanks, Hugo. Thank you, brother.
Megan, coming to you for the final question.
Thank you. Hi, and thank you, Hugo, for having this.
Hey.
So my mum runs like a plastic-free business locally, it's obviously. And she's tried to reach out to like the local like MPs and everything to try and get support and like help to try and get like the message out there a bit more to get it in the supermarkets and everything like that. But she's had like no success because they're just like, oh yeah, we've got like this scheme in place for like 2030. Mm-hmm. She's got like a few charities that she's working with, but have you got any advice for like what else you can do to kind of get more people involved, as it were?
Yeah, totally. Look, I would recommend she drops, you know, one of my team a line. I've got a colleague called Rachel who runs the Plastic Free Communities initiative. Amazing, 800 communities around the country, bringing together businesses like your mum's, local politicians, local schools, other charities to collaborate on reducing the plastic footprint of that area. There's a brilliant business community within that. Lots of people coming together to work out plans of how to do more. So yeah, do get in touch. There's a website, plasticfree.org, I think our URL is, which has all of the details about that. It's a really powerful network, and we'd really welcome her getting involved.
Thank you.
Hugo, thank you so much for your time. I know you've had a busy couple of weeks with World Ocean Day and G7, and it's been an absolute privilege and pleasure to spend this time with you this morning. So thank you so much. Have you got any final words? And can you just give the guys an idea of where we can find you in terms of websites, etc.?
Well, look, thank you so much, Paul. And it's been a real pleasure to talk to everyone and brilliant questions and, you know, an honour to be here with you today. If people want to get involved, do check out our website, sas.org.uk. You can also find us on Instagram, on Twitter, which is at SAS Campaigns. You know, there's an abundance of information out there on Facebook too. I'm on Twitter at Hugo SAS and on Instagram at Hugo Tag Home. You know, I tell stories there. I'm also on LinkedIn where I keep a sort of regular blog of what we're doing. So loads of places to connect. Do get involved. I think we all want to feel empowered. Let's all get empowered in our day-to-day lives with the small actions we can take. And don't ever think you have to do everything. You can't do everything. Do what you can. You know, use your voice, you know, get empowered. But also, you know, lend your voice to organizations, whether it's Seaspiracy, Surface Against Sewage, Friends of the Earth, the Blue Marine Foundation, and just get involved with the organizations that you like. Give them your voice. Help support what they do. They rely on people like you to make sure they're campaigns and their projects have impact. So your voice will always count, and make sure you use it for the issues you care about most.
Thanks very much, Hugo. Guys, can we have a round of applause for Hugo and flash your mics for the appreciation? There we go. Thank you, Hugo. Thanks once again.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Winners Club. If you have taken some practical lessons and learnings from some of the most impactful conversations on Clubhouse, then we would love your support for this show by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts.